Good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Maricela Morales, and I serve as Deputy Executive Director of the Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy, CAUSE for short. We are based in Ventura County, but we serve the six-county Central Coast region. For us, the Central Coast region includes Ventura up through Santa Cruz County. For the purposes of this presentation, I'm sharing information about the Central Coast as you identify it geographically from Santa Barbara up through Santa Cruz County. And I want to share also as well that separately, I'm a retired city council member and mayor of a coastal community in Ventura County and served on the Ventura Council of Governments and was a representative from that body to the Southern California Association of Governments. So for us at CAUSE, our mission is to realize social, economic, and environmental justice. And these 8 minutes will focus on that. This board, this body, is a public board, and as such, its constituents, per se, are the public. And we've spent much of today focusing on, from my perspective, on the concerns of 100 growers that may or may not fall into Tier 3. This body's constituents, as again I see it, are the 1.2 million people that are in the Central Coast Water Board region. In particular, there is the low-income communities of color in this region, and I'm going to share some 2010 census data for the Central Coast Water Board region with regards to water quality, agriculture, and people. And for me, this visual is very powerful because it's showing what is pitted against one another, unfortunately, and what we have to resolve. But in the middle, ultimately, it's children and families. And more and more in our communities, it's children such as this little girl. She's from Oaxaca, so indigenous, low income, and people of color. As has been said before, there are many issues to address, one of which is our coastal resources. The 300 miles of the California coastline covered by this board accounts for about 27% of the total coastline. And that, too, has an impact on the economy locally. And to the extent that beaches are closed or that people cannot enjoy that recreation, that is an economic impact to the community as well. So the Central Coast accounts for 8% of the state's total land area, but 26% of the state's crop market value. And this information came from USC's Program for Environmental and Regional Equity. So 26% of the state's crop market value. Nevertheless, we see food justice, so access to these foods is no more difficult or easier in the Central Coast than it is for other parts of California. So these very same communities that are low income, many of them farm worker families concentrated in the Central Coast who are working these fields, are not having access to the very fruits and vegetables that they're growing for health. And yet again, there's a large percentage of the wealth in terms of crop market value in this region. So on top of not having access to the very fruits of their labor, literally, they are pressed with the environmental concerns that then become very personal physical health concerns for them, including pregnant women, and that being pesticides. And we've talked about the impacts of pesticides to waters, but I want to point out that these communities are facing not only that, but on top of that, the exposure directly when they are working in the fields. The majority, 86%, being Latino. So I'll read just some of these. These are directly from the report. It's a litany, and it's only part of the litany of the impacts. The concentration in the Salinas Valley and Santa Maria in the Hollister groundwater basin, the California Department of Public Health has identified over half of the drinking water supplies there as vulnerable to, because of discharges from agriculture-related activities. The costs of groundwater pollution, as has been stated before, the excessive concentrations of nitrate or nitrite in drinking water being hazardous to human health. More so. These are more statistics from the report. 82% of the worst water quality sites are in the Salinas and Santa Maria areas. So that gets us to the concentrated poverty, so the people that are dealing with these problems. In this community, there has been prosperity for some, but the lowest income workers, and again, the farm workers would fall into this, have seen losses in income, while the wealthiest in the region have seen gains. And while I understand that growers have a short or small profit margin, I doubt that they're in the lowest 10th percentile, and that's where these families are at. So this community, this is 2010 census data. Central Coast is now 47.8% people of color, and that includes Latino, Black, Asian Pacific Islander, and Native American. So almost half, one out of two. But if we look at the communities in which the concentrated contamination is, they are overrepresented by people of color. 69% in Hollister, and in the Salinas Valley, the community of Chualar, which I've heard since 2001 has had difficulties with health quality water, almost 100% people of color. Gonzales, 91%. Santa Maria, 76%. Salinas, 83%. Salinas is by far the largest city in the region, 150,000 people. The next largest city is 100,000, and that's Santa Maria. So by far the people impacted are the poorest and people of color. Median income. Central Coast, it ranges anywhere from $58,000 to $66,000. Nevertheless, again, poverty concentrated in these areas, you know, as low as $41,000. That's $20,000, $25,000 actually, less than the high median income. Big, big differences, and these are the very communities that are having to pay out of pocket, or the municipalities where they are concentrated in, having to pay somehow, find the revenue in order to cover the costs. The point being that we continually hear from the industry, where's the money? And yet, you know, we haven't seen here today that the people have had the money to pay for studies from universities, to pay for attorneys, to pay for independent scientists to come here, because these folks don't have the money to do that. They don't have the money to defend themselves, and that's why we're here today. So to end, echoing what has been said by the Monterey Coastkeeper Coalition, as well as the Environmental Justice Coalition, our first choice is the February 2010, but if not that, then the current version with the modifications communicated by the Monterey Coastkeeper. One recommendation, you know, little has been said about small farms, but in speaking with Dr. Stephen Gleisman, the chair of agroecology at UC Santa Cruz, he saw a need to further actually look at the impacts to small sustainable farms, and so that would be a recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments.
Mr. Chair, can I ask her where she got her data from?
Yes, which data was that?
Well, you gave percentages of cities, and you gave this is the median income. Where did you get
yes.
that information
so
from?
So this is from the U.S. Census for the larger communities, but communities that are either under 20,000 or under 50,000, you have to go to the American Community Survey, ACS data, and that's a survey that's done either every 3 years for the cities over 20,000 or every 5 years for communities under 20,000.
So was this taken off the 2000 census or the 2010 census?
For what is available for the larger communities is 2008 data. Again, what is available for smaller communities, it's the American Community Survey, which is done, it's a survey that's done either on a 3-year basis or on a 5-year basis. So that's most current information available.
So Salinas on this is the only one that meets the large city? It's the only one that's over 100,000?
Right. Well, let's see. Yes. Yes. Santa Maria might have fallen into that. They're at about 100,000 right now. But most of the Salinas Valley, with the exception of Salinas, that information came from ACS
data. And your previous slide to this one? Where does that data come from?
That comes from 2010 census data.
2010.
Yes.
Any board comments or questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Okay, channel keeper. So, folks, this is our last kind of group presentation, if you want to call it that, or extended presentation, and then we'll talk about how to divvy up the rest of our time. With whatever's left.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Ben Pitterly. I'm the Watershed Programs Director with Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. I run our water quality monitoring programs. We've been doing watershed monitoring in our area since 2001. I'm quite familiar with water quality issues in our area. I also served as a member on the stakeholder panel that met from December 2008 to September 2009. And I followed this issue closely throughout this entire process and throughout the multiple drafts and revisions that have been made. And because of these experiences, I feel as though I have earned some perspective that I want to offer today. I think it's important to consider perspective, given some of the reoccurring themes that I keep hearing from the agricultural community who's been largely opposed to this process. And one of those themes, what I keep hearing, is that the agricultural community has not been representative, that their concerns have not been considered by staff or incorporated into the order. Now, what I want to do with my time here is just briefly do some comparisons of early versions of the order and the current draft and give some examples of what the latest draft will actually mean for growers in my area. And when we do this, what I'm hoping that this will help some people realize just how far we have actually come since that first draft, and for better or worse, how much the agricultural community's input actually has been incorporated. And I think what you'll see is that this draft proposed today is very far from the broad brushstroke set of regulations that the ag community is voiced concern about. And in fact, the reality is that the latest draft will likely not pose any significant additional requirements on growers in my area at all, and in some cases might even make things less stringent. So my area, my work covers the watersheds from Point Conception east to, for this region's sake, Rincon Creek, or the edge of Santa Barbara County. We do some work in the Ventura River, but that's the LA region. We cover the frontal range, so these are the coastal streams that drain to the Pacific, not the San Ynez River. There are many more streams than are actually shown here on this map, but it gives you a sense of the area. And we do have significant agriculture, primarily in the Goleta and Carpinteria Valleys. So let's talk about the tiering system we're all familiar with by now. There are three tiers. A useful comparison that's been made by staff and others is how the tier system compares to the existing 2004 order. Tier 1 is less stringent, 2 tiers about the same, and we can expect that Tier 3 growers will likely have more requirements than they do today. Now, back in February, we didn't have such thing as a Tier 1 category, but there was something called low risk, and I want to look closely at what it took to get into that low risk category. Growers A had to eliminate all tailwater. B, they had to be more than 1,000 feet from any impaired surface water body. So today, Tier 1, it's actually much easier to get into Tier 1 today. Growers do not need to eliminate all of their tailwater. They can't use chlorpyrifos or diazinon. They have to be more than 1,000 feet from these specific types of impairments. And if they grow high nitrate risk crops, then they have to be less than 1,000 acres and more than 1,000 feet from a public supply well. This is important. Tier 1 is less stringent than the existing 2004 order, primarily because they won't be required to submit annual compliance forms. And I want to give you an example of what this could mean for our areas. So this is San Jose Creek. This is an aerial photo, and you can see there that yellow tack represents one of our monitoring sites. You can see from this photo there's really not a whole lot in the way of development upstream of that monitoring site. If you zoom in a little closely, you see there is some development, and it's pretty much entirely agricultural development, and it's highlighted here in orange. Now, these operations are not high-risk crops. They are not within 1,000 feet of a nutrient, sediment, pesticide, toxicity, or turbidity-impaired water. And the first thing I would expect a grower to do is if they're using chlorpyrifos or diazinon, they're probably going to switch to effectively put themselves into Tier 1. Now, San Jose Creek isn't listed for those specific impairments, but it is listed for many water quality impairments, and you can see what they are here. They're displayed, and I know that there are probably several people in this room who will immediately start arguing and say that these things actually aren't agricultural contaminants, but that actually just isn't true. We know salts can be, and the fact is that uncomposted or partially composted cow manure is a source of fecal bacteria. And studies have shown that pathogenic organisms can persist for long periods of time, up to almost a year, even in properly composted manure. Okay, I'm really not here to argue whether or not these specific impairments are caused by ag or not. And I will give them this, that where there's smoke does not necessarily mean that there's fire. But it doesn't mean that there necessarily isn't. Okay, and you wouldn't simply ignore a smoke alarm if it went off in your house. And if you look at this map, you look where our monitoring site's located, and you look at the condition of this stream, are we really prepared to put this type of operation in Tier 1? And are we really ready to do that without considering, in fact, a single thing about what actual practices are occurring? All that we're considering, all that we know, is that they're not using two specific pesticides. Please keep in mind that this isn't a discussion about requiring more of this operation. What we're actually talking about is putting them in a category where there will be less required, and frankly, we think that's extremely generous to the agricultural community, and in fact, we think it's neither wise or appropriate. We think Tier 1 should be reserved for sustainability and practice certified or other certified programs approved by the executive officer or, at a minimum, require elimination of tailwater. I want to run quickly through some of the other requirements. So individual discharge monitoring. In February, all discharges were going to be required to do discharge monitoring. Today, it's reserved only for Tier 3 growers. Milestones. Back in February, all dischargers were required to eliminate discharges to any water body from toxicity, sediment, turbidity, nutrients, and salts. Today, only Tier 3 dischargers are actually required to demonstrate reduction through actual monitoring, and the percentage of reduction has been reduced from all to 75% for turbidity and sediment and 50% for nutrient loads. Nutrient and irrigation management. Back in February, all dischargers to any water body were required to include very specific irrigation and nutrient management information in their farm plan. Today, I'm trying to get through my presentation. Today only Tier 3 dischargers are actually required to submit nutrient irrigation and nutrient management plans. It's apparent that Tier 3 is very important in this order, so I want to look closely at what it actually takes to get into Tier 3. We're familiar at this point, I think, with the two things that will get you there. First, growers who grow high nitrogen risk crops and are greater than 1,000 acres in operation size, or B, they apply chlorpyrifos and diazinon, and they discharge to a 303D water body listed for toxicity or pesticides. So I'd like to look at another example. This is a list of water bodies in our area that are officially impaired by either nutrients, and they're shown there on the left, or pesticides or toxicity, shown on the right. And now the first thing you'd notice if you tour our area, and that you might notice if you take a careful look at this background image, is that we don't have a lot of high nitrate risk crops as defined by staff. We have nutrient impairments, but most of the ag activity in our area is actually orchards. It's citrus and avocados, and they aren't on the list. We do have some row crops, but again, if you look closely at this example, which has some parcel boundaries drawn, we do not have operations anywhere near 1,000 acres. What does that mean for Tier 3 in terms of nutrient requirements? It means we don't have any. Not a single operation will be enrolled as Tier 3 for nutrient risk from the Gaviota Coast to Ventura County. And that means there will not be any irrigation and nutrient management plans and no nitrogen balance ratio targets. We still do have pesticides, and we have toxicity listings, so we should expect that there will be some additional requirements, except, to be honest, what I'm fully expecting and what I guess many people in this room either publicly or secretly expect is that within 2 years, each grower along these toxic streams will simply switch pesticides to avoid additional regulation. They will not use chlorpyrifos or diazinon, and as a result, we will have no individual discharge monitoring requirements in our area. Now, will this solve the toxicity problem in our area? Probably not. And we think this is another huge gap. And to fill this gap, in addition to the language that was presented earlier by Monterey Coastkeeper, we feel as though pyrethroid pesticides, at a minimum, should be added to the Tier 3 criteria. So Ag's own CMP study found that pyrethroid pesticides were the most prevalent and severe sources of toxicity to sediments in the region. So why would you link Tier 3 requirements solely to two other pesticides? We don't know why, because it really doesn't make sense. Finally, I want to speak quickly about riparian buffers. In February, all growers were going to be required to have 50-foot buffers minimum. Today, only growers adjacent to sediment, turbidity, temperature-impaired water bodies must develop a water quality buffer plan. That's not the same thing as a minimum buffer. And I should add to this, it's not shown, but you also must be in a Tier 3 discharger. So what does this mean for our area? Here's a list of all major water bodies in our area that have irrigated agricultural activities. And how many of these water bodies will be subject to the riparian buffer plan requirements based on today's draft? There's one. So again, this idea that the board is taking broad brush strokes that are going to significantly affect the agricultural community at large is simply not accurate. And again, this is my main point. It isn't that I think all of these operations should be heavily regulated, but it's that board staff has taken great pains to incorporate the concerns of the agricultural community into this draft. And in our opinion, the proposed order swings even too far in the opposite direction to be effective. This draft has so many loopholes and is so selective in how it applies its protections that there will be very large areas throughout the region that will not benefit at all from the additional accountability and enforceability that was originally intended. To wrap it up, this is my son, Wyatt, and this is a picture of him in our backyard on Carpinteria Creek. The creek runs through our property. We're near the bottom, near the ocean. And you can tell from this photo that Wyatt is very concerned. You can tell by that look on his face, that's his concerned look. And he's concerned because he found out that Carpinteria Creek is polluted, and he feels like he should be able to play in a creek that runs through his own backyard on his own property without having to worry about pollution. And frankly, I'm concerned too, so are a great many other people. And we're concerned that if this process keeps dragging on, which is how it looks like in May, if it keeps going the way it's been going, pretty soon this order is going to be so watered down, it'll be so toothless that there will essentially be no change at all. And I think that's just the way ag wants it. Frankly, I've been surprised so many folks even bothered showing up today. I think they've already won and they don't even know it. In conclusion, I ask you, please consider what's been presented here. Consider how far this thing has swung since February. We don't think farmers are bad people. We really don't. We do strongly disagree about what it's going to take to solve our water quality problems. And we believe our water quality problems are very serious. It's really time we move this thing along, and we hope that you'll consider incorporating our recommendations into the draft and you recommend its approval. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments. Any questions for Channel Keeper? Okay. Thank you very much. And I thought Wyatt was actually saying, "Hey, Dad, I'm hungry. You know, where's the snack you promised me?" Okay, folks, we have not enough time to give everybody 3 minutes. There's no question about that. We don't have enough time for that. We don't have enough time for staff, for the board to even kind of deliberate and decide what, if any, recommendations to give. And so those are both two very important functions that have to get completed. I don't really want to short circuit either of them. I am thinking that we need to continue this meeting, and it would be sooner than the next board meeting. The next board meeting would be May 5th in San Luis Obispo. But we've spent a lot of time on this now, and I think we're hopefully beginning, at least the board is beginning to kind of narrow down some things in its mind as to what it would like to see addressed by staff. I'm thinking we should have a board meeting just to deal with the balance of this, whatever we can't finish today, sometime in April, because I don't trust that we can really finish this if we, you know, attach this to another board meeting. So I thought we were doing pretty good today, just allocating one day for this, and look how wrong I turned out to be. And we started at 8:15, so we're going to need to think about another day, Mr. Briggs and staff, as to when we could continue this. What I would like to do is finish as much of the public comment that we can today, and then we'll talk about how we're going to allocate that time. And I think we're going to end up completing that at the continuation of this board meeting, and then we'll have board deliberation and comment and recommendations. So, and just for the public, what would then happen, because there's going to be another board meeting after that. So once we give staff recommendations, staff is going to need to do what it does, make changes, analyze, possibly receive more public comment on that, and then there would be another board meeting. So that's what I'm thinking. That makes sense, Mr. Briggs?
Well, it makes sense, although the part about additional public comments, my understanding is that would be if there was something that was significantly outside the realm of what we've been discussing. If it's something within the scope of the various options and alternatives that have been already talked about in our written materials, then that would not necessarily prompt another round of public comments.
Okay. Well, we'll see.
Right.
After we get through the next.
And then what that would also allow is in April, then essentially you would hope that, assuming we don't have another board member, that then the panel would be able to vote in terms of bringing a recommendation to the full board. And that would be direction to staff in terms of what you want to see in that, in bringing that to the full board.
Right.
Okay.
So, any board comments or suggestions, or you don't like, you like, you want it different?
I agree there's no way to finish today, and to try to squeeze it into another regular board hearing I don't think is doable either. I agree with you completely. So we need to find another time to do that between now and May.
Mr. Hodgen, any thoughts on?
I'm concerned that we use as much time as possible for those who are here that want to speak to. Let's get that on, and then certainly we're going to have another meeting.
Okay. All right.
I agree to that, Mr. Chair, but I think that another question would be, since this order is going to terminate on the end of March, then what happens is that hasn't been addressed today.
Mr. Briggs is going to have to deal with that as an administrative function.
Yeah.
We can't vote on it.
No, we can't vote on it.
So it's not in our hands.
I agree.
Mr. Briggs will have to figure out with Francis what can be done about it.
Go to the mountaintop.
Okay. All right. Now, here's what I'm thinking about with the speakers. We've got how many? 70? We have 70 cards. I don't know how many are still here. I would like to make this suggestion that those of you that cannot make the continuation of this, that perhaps you allow the others that are not going to be able to come to another board meeting. Well, it would be in San Luis Obispo. Okay. When? In April?
Yes.
Do you want us to pick a date now? Does that help everyone's decision-making?
Can't do that now?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
One consideration is that you, instead of adding a board meeting in April, add a day to the May meeting.
Okay.
In San Luis Obispo.
May 4th, for example, or May 6th.
Well, May 4th is a Wednesday. What's that?
I like Fridays.
You like Fridays better.
If we do it with the May board meeting, then there won't be a chance for staff to make adjustments after the panel discusses and makes suggestions.
Well, see,
and so we won't be able to bring anything to the board for approval.
That's right. I mean, at the May meeting, what would happen is we would only be able to tell staff the recommendations we think are appropriate, and then they still have to come back at a later board meeting. So the question really is just when do we have this next board meeting to finish this? Do it like on May 4th or 6th, or do we do it in April? I mean, I'd rather get this over with, just because this is taking a lot of time, and I have a lot of thoughts in my mind right now, and I've got to reduce it to writing. And, you know, the immediacy of it leaves a little bit, and I don't want to wait too long to complete this part of it, and I want to give staff direction. But if you want to back it up to the May board meeting, then just tell me. Mr. Hodgen?
Well, I just have to comment that the May board meeting is also the National Day of Prayer. That may...
Maybe we can do that instead.
I think we'll do a lot of that between now and then anyway.
It's also a Cinco de Mayo, so we've got to have a party. Huh.
Okay, so I need some help, you guys, and it's the board that is going to kind of decide this somewhat. Do you guys want to do it in April? April? Can we find a date, Roger? And
I don't think we can do that right now.
We can't do that right now?
For continuance?
Well, yeah, I think they're trying to.
Why don't we go ahead with comment?
Okay.
Instead of deliberating on this.
Well, okay.
And how much time do we have left?
In a second. How about it, can we say that we can do this either the week of April 18th or 25th? Can we find a day to do this during the weeks of April 18th or April 25th? Can't do those 2 weeks? You're out of town.
What's the difficulty with trying to do it now? We'll have to compare a lot of schedules.
Okay. All right. So that's not going to work. So it will be in San Luis Obispo. That's all I can tell you. Okay. Okay. April 7th is out. But so we'll have to come back with the date and notice it. But so let's do this. I'd like to give people that cannot make it to San Luis Obispo and that are here as much time as possible, okay? I don't know how many there are of you in that category. So maybe you could give me a show of hands of those that aren't going to show up in San Luis Obispo. And let me just say this. I'm going to keep these cards so that, you know, if you get the time to speak now, this is just a continuation of this board meeting, and you're not going to be able to speak during public comment in San Luis Obispo. It's the only way to make this fair. So who can't make San Luis Obispo? Okay, good. So let me, and you've all submitted cards to me? Do I have cards? Okay. So let's do this.
Why don't you have them
lineup?
Have about five line up, and I'll say their name, and we'll pull them out.
Okay, so let's do that. What I'd like to do,
we'll
try this. You'll get, I think we can do 3 minutes each on the hands that I saw. So if people could line up, and I'm not going to call names, I'm just going to let you come up just five at a time. And when there's five, you can line up all the way to the back if you want, but wherever you want to do it, and that'll expedite this.
We'll do is we'll write their names down. We can't sift through these every time.
Okay.
So we'll just write their names down.
All right.
Bob, that's the quickest I've seen you move in a long time.
Okay.
Yes, I'm on.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hold on 1 second. Okay, so what staff is going to do is write your names down, and that's what we're going to keep track of. Okay, so the cards I'm not going to be looking at now.
Just give your name.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. My
name, Roger,
is Bob Martin, General Manager of Real Farms in King City. I just wanted to comment on some of the things that we've done in the past and where we're going. Over the past 15 years or so, our operation, along with many others, has taken water quality protection seriously. We farm over 6,000 acres in the King City area. As technology brings us information that we can use to lessen negative impacts on water quality, we listen, we learn, and we improvise. The sheer size of our operation allows us to experiment and utilize improved methods. If they prove successful, we're not shy in sharing these results with fellow farmers. I have 15 growers that are raising onions for our company right now, and I share everything with them. Quick nitrate soil testing has been in our program for close to 15 years now. Backflow prevention devices have been in all of our wells for as long as I can remember. I can't understand why our large operation is singled out in the staff's proposal as the highest risk category. As if that isn't bad enough, your proposal doesn't allow for any possibility for operations over 1,000 acres to move into a different tier without the exclusive written permission of your executive officer. Where is the incentive for someone in Tier 3 to improve their impacts on surface of groundwater? I submit that allowing for a true assessment of an operation's impact on water quality can only be made objectively by a comprehensive review process of an audit committee offered in ag proposal. Over the past 15 years, I have impressed upon farmers the need to contain and capture their irrigation tailwater. This hasn't been discussed here yet today. In staff's proposal, all of these ponds must be lined to not allow for percolation of this tailwater back into the groundwater. Typically, these ponds will contain a fair amount of sediment that must be cleaned out at least annually. If they are lined, that doesn't allow for that activity. Can't do it. First of all, how does staff know that the quality of the water, what is the quality of the water in that pond? Why are they taking for granted that it is laden with nutrients and pesticides? Even if there are some nutrients in that water, why do they believe that the same constituents and at those concentrations will penetrate multiple clay layers above deep aquifers over a period of 30 to 50 years to contaminate that deep groundwater? What data currently exists that supports staff's theory? At a recent nutrient and irrigation management seminar, and this is the one that I think staff referred to as all CCAs were there. No, they were all farmers, and there was about two or three CCAs there. Dr. Thomas Harder, the foremost authority on groundwater in California, showed some very interesting slides. And one I grabbed onto real quickly is a graph showing nitrate changes of shallow or young water in Monterey County. Now, understand, young water is shallow water in sandy areas that can be reflected from what you're applying on the surface to where you're pumping from in a matter of a year to 5 years. That's considered young water. It showed a marked improvement regarding nitrate contamination in each of these three five-year samples taken. What does this show? It was pretty obvious to me that whoever was farming in that vicinity had made marked improvements in their fertilizer and irrigation management practices.
Can you wrap it up, Mr.
So
Martin?
That's it. Okay, I've got more, but you have the copy, and you have the graph from Dr. Thomas Harder, and if you need more information, you can probably contact him to find out what it's all about.
Okay. Thank you for your
comments. Thank you very much.
I'm Dick Hartman, president of Biosphere Enhancement Corporation out of Portland, Oregon. I have patents, throughout the United States patents and throughout the world regards clean water fertilizer additive. I drove 11 hours to get here. These 25 years, this is a culmination of wanting people to want to be interested in this concept. Submit, follow the money. Regards current incentives to reduce the costs of government. If I were a grower here, I think I'd say, what? The nitrogen I paid that much money for is getting on my neighbor's place? What? The pesticides that I want just to be on my farm is going somewhere else? I'll tell you, that stuff's expensive. They don't want to lose it. Any money on it. They don't want to lose that to anybody. There's a somewhat of a rumor that upcoming congressman or something said maybe change the EPA to the EHA, the Environmental Help Association, agency. The 501-590 program for best management programs just learned is offering $36 per acre to any farmer who will try enhanced efficiency fertilizers and leave check strips that can be checked. Now, I submit a thought. When you monetize the activity that this staff is going to have all your time, all the groups here, and for the next 5 years, when you monetize that, I just submit a simple thought. The Farm Bureau-supported independent operation here to look over things, what if they had a small portion of the money that's going to be spent in following something up as nebulous as nitrogen and made an incentive to growers to say, if you'll do a nitrogen and or pesticide improvement tools, one of which would be ours, then you'll be able to get an incentive pay. This $36 on a $1,000 acre farm would be $36,000. I think they could gladly, and they will be glad to implement any modern tools that can take care of that. So I submit that it will only take one person about a year with these incentives out here to have the growers know that that's possible to implement. And that then would be accounted for easily by saying, here's the record of all the growers who have done these improvements. Submit that would be cost-effective and totally effective. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Hartman.
Robin Lee. I'm from Salinas.
Your last name?
Lee.
Lee, L-E-E?
Correct. So I want to, I like to know that the creek I live on is Santa Rita Creek. It flows through North Salinas, and it's been it's seen a death. It's in the throes of death from the last, 20 or 30 years. People I've talked to who grew up on the creek will no longer let their children play in the creek that they did as kids because they're concerned about pollution. So the creek is highly degraded by ag runoff. There used to be ranch land and the headwaters, and that is converting to row crop. And with the increase of row crop acreage, the degradation has gotten greater and greater. And now there's sediment problems causing flooding and damage. And the people I've talked to, they've talked to all officials in their area, and they have no recourse. Now, it's directly related to the sediment coming off the row crop land, irrigated row crop land that was once rangeland. So what recourse these people have that now they're getting damage to their property and their structures because of sediment runoff from irrigated ag land through stormwater and irrigated water runoff? It used to be an intermittent stream. Now it's perennial because ag runoff. And every time the water hits the stream, it's carrying massive amount of sediment. And then we know sediment transports all manner of other things with it. So what recourse do we have with this sediment issue? We also want to do some creek restoration work on there, and we can't do it because of the sediment. They're now requiring dredging because of West Nile virus. If we could vegetate and put trees up to keep the growth down in the creek channel, we wouldn't have an issue. But we can't do that because we have to dredge the sediment. So what are we supposed to do? I'd like to know if there's recourse in this, in the, what you're proposing to this tiered system that you're proposing to pass. Can someone answer me that?
Well, we can't answer that now. What I would suggest to you, because I think those are great questions, that you maybe contact staff when we're not dealing with this particular item, because I don't think there's anything in the order that's going to address the issues you're raising.
It does for sediment.
Well, it does, but it's
a 303D stream.
Right, but it sounds like she has some specific issues with property owners receiving sediment.
Yes, and causing flooding and structural inundation, actually.
Francis?
The order does include sediment controls.
Right.
I think you're correct that this isn't the appropriate thing to answer the questions and that they should call staff or me, or you can call me and
I thought
I can
the
help.
Tier 1 had a sediment component to it to control the sediment coming off the property.
Well, all the tier, they have a sediment, they have to do sediment management as part of their farm plan, correct? Yes.
And they have to implement?
Yes. Yes.
So then it should be, if I were to contact staff and say, look, they're discharging sediment, they're not meeting their permit, then they should be able to go and talk to them to get them to do what they're supposed to do. If not, then it'd be fines. And that wouldn't that happen?
Do you live in the city of Salinas?
Yes.
You do. Well, you have an issue there. You know, I mean, if someone is discharging sediment onto your property, that's a trespass.
Well, I don't think we should give her legal advice about it.
She should
talk to the staff and see if they can address the problem.
But I thought it would be tied into this.
Yeah, but I don't.
You've made your comment, and we really have to move on, but you can talk to staff to see what your particular issue is.
It's doing two things, structural damage preventing restoration for recreational and habitat purposes.
You should talk to staff, though, and they can talk to you about that. We just can't get into an individual solution right here to this, but it's a legitimate problem. I don't want to de-minimize that by anything I've said, but and who knows what's going to happen with this permit and what it's going to look like and whether it's going to take care of the issues that are going to satisfy you. That I don't know either at this point. So, but talk to staff after this meeting, and they can help you more directly. Okay? Next.
Good evening. I'm just here because I care. And
pardon me.
My name is Joan Bennett. From Salinas, okay. And I like to eat, so I like the farmers, but everybody here, what a monumental task. You know, I've been told that there's supposed to be cover crop all around us in Salinas. I've seen two farms with cover crop. If we can't even get the people to put the cover crop, how are you going to solve this issue? But anyway, think about this. The Salinas River, we have these rubber dams so that we can collect water and use that water to irrigate. But then there's other areas of the Salinas River where we don't have the dam because the water is so polluted, they won't let it go into the rubber dam area, and it has to go into the river so it goes into the bay. Well, if I had 100 trucks of polluted water and sprayed it on a farmer's property, I would get thrown in jail or fined. If I did the same thing and took it to the bay and sprayed it in the bay, I would get thrown in jail or fined. We all want to have a winning situation. I'm just saying, please, maybe somebody should start thinking with their heart a little bit and not just their pocketbook. Think of a little scenario. Your child is dying from cancer. We know that the children and the senior people, they're more susceptible to carcinogenic substances. This diazinon, I've heard that 83% is used in the Salinas Valley out of the entire state of California. Well, that's a lot of carcinogenic substances. I'm not saying this farm's doing it, that farm's doing it. I'm just saying this is an issue. We're all trying to resolve it. But just think, if your son looked at you and said, Dad, I'm 10, my sister's 4, I don't want any more chemotherapy because I'm dying. And they say this is why it's happening. Can't you do something better so maybe my sister won't die? So I'm just saying, when you're thinking about all this and you're figuring, okay, how much money how much profit I'm making. Are you really making that much profit if your child is dying? Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Bennett, for your comments.
My name is Elizabeth Ward. I appreciate the chance to speak. I live in Monterey. We live in a free market, but not a free-for-all. The public has the right to set conditions for use of shared resources like water. And growers have the choice of whether and what to grow given the conditions set. In the end, the cost of monitoring is borne by the public through free market prices, and that is a cost I'm willing to bear for health. Stopping the public from deciding how shared water is to be protected is as repressive as stopping farmers from choosing what to grow. The farm lobbyists working to weaken the draft standards to a level where there's no individual reporting or progress milestones would gut the public's ability to protect public health. Without individual progress, there can be no collective progress. I support working with farmers to ameliorate the financial and logistical impact of testing, but I cannot support reliance on the creators of toxicity themselves to investigate their own impacts. Please stand up for taxpayers by supporting our right to set conditions for health and independently monitor compliance by the largest-scale users of shared water. You start with the large-scale users. If you find that a lot of the impact is not done by them, then you go to the smaller scale, but you got to start somewhere. If the feedback today is dominated by large farm families and corporations instead of individuals like myself, keep in mind that they are effectively paid millions of future dollars for every public health concession they can wrest from you today. For missing a whole day's worth of work, I'm out of $800 instantly. But it's worth it to me, and I do it again, because the health of children and the health of the marine life that floats our tourism economy is worth every penny to me. I beg of you to stand behind monitoring and reporting of nitrates and any toxin suspected of affecting the health of communities larger than 100 people. And I specifically ask you to go back to the draft standards prior 2 years ago that had a lot more chemicals for monitoring, and I ask you to add those back, and I ask you to make a place for citizens who are affected to get in the system and ask for monitoring of specific chemicals that they suspect. Thank you for listening. I'm done.
Thank you for your comments, Ms. Ward.
Good afternoon. My name is Martha Guzman. I work with the California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation. And I wanted to speak on behalf of some of the communities I've had the privilege of working with in the past 10 years or so, and some of the folks that were here today, but they couldn't wait around, and other folks work. One was mentioned earlier today, Chular, Camp Jimenez, Canfora, San Ardo, San Lucas. And San Lucas, and these are communities that are groundwater dependent. They can afford one well and struggle for the financing of additional wells, because frankly, they don't have the option of much more than drilling a little deeper. There is actually more than just a drinking water situation that is impacted by not having water. In San Lucas, there's an affordable housing project that is being held up because of the water situation. So it's not just drinking water and health impacts, it's actually, you know, habitability and having people have decent housing is a big piece of this as well. I want to mention more of my comments around the nitrates, but I will say that we are very concerned, although we agree that diazinon and chlorpyrifos are some of the worst acting pesticides, we're very concerned with the swap effect, if you will. So we do prefer the February 2010 proposal for that and other reasons. Returning to the nitrate situation on these communities, and it's really, you know, hard to explain to people sometimes about how this is not just a simple fix about drilling a new well. Sometimes it is, and that lasts for about 5 to 10 years, and sometimes you have to go really far out and put in a big pipeline. So one of the clear solutions that is in this proposal, and maybe it is for the long term, is the nitrogen management plans and giving farmers the tools to know, you know, how overcompensating is sometimes not even cost-effective for them or not necessarily yield anything. Well, that's probably not true. But the point being is that they could have this more efficient tool. And you can go about it two ways. I think Steve was recommending that it go into Tier 3. But you could conversely require everyone from Tier 2 to having these nutrient management plans. And it's something that is so basic from our perspective to have a nutrient management plan that we don't think it's, you know, some of the other triggers other than really having this trigger universally for Tier 2 and Tier 3, especially because we're concerned about how the swapping will work and how a farmer will move from one tier to the other. And finally, something that has been loosely mentioned is really addressing this drinking water problem now and having some way that this order is going to provide for that mitigation today so that in the interim of 20, 50, or 100 years when you can once again drill into a well without treatment, you actually have an alternative for these communities today. I mean, you wouldn't need this regulation if people could drink from their groundwater wells. So we really hope that the industry could support us in that and really focusing on a solution for potable water today.
Thank you for your comments.
Good afternoon. I'm Reverend Lindy Ramsden. I'm the Senior Minister and Executive Director of the Unitarian Universalist Legislative Ministry in California. And since I don't think I'll be able to make it on the day of prayer to your meeting, I will at least share with you a cartoon about Moses. There's a cartoon with Moses, and he's looking at the burning bush, and in his hand is a fire extinguisher. And the comment at the bottom says, "Moses blows the job interview." Moses blows the job interview. You all here and those in this valley and all along the Central Coast in a certain way have been called into a moment in history where we're facing climate change, where we're looking at the human right to water, where we're seeing the difficulties that farmers face and the terrible problems faced by the communities that don't have access to safe, affordable water. And you are being asked in your regulatory authority to step into a very, very important moment in history and an important moment in time. I applaud the staff for their work, others who have made their presentations, and I wish you well in coming to your discernment. I do want to say that in addition to all of the challenges and costs that growing food in an unsustainable way creates to our water systems, our health, the abilities of communities to get loans, there's also a cost to the fabric of community that we see here, sectors torn apart one from the other. But I think that we can't turn a blind eye to what is going on. And those of us who are consumers of food need to start realizing that we have to pay a lot more at the grocery store. In a sense, we've been getting off cheap for what food really costs. We need to be able to get the right price signals from the market for those of us who seek to live an ethical life about what the actual cost is of what we are buying. And it's very important that those who are creating waste are the ones that end up taking responsibility for that waste rather than putting the costs on the lowest income members of our community. Implementing strong agricultural regulations will help to assure that responsible growers will not be at a competitive disadvantage with those who take less care to avoid polluting our water. Education is important, and voluntary farm plans are important, but they're not sufficient. It's only through the regulation of pollution with measurable outcomes, timelines, and enforcement that a whole industry can make the move to the next level of safety, accountability, and predictability. Unitarian Universalists in California have been active in efforts to realize the human right to water. In early March, we were privileged to accompany the United Nations independent expert on the human right to water and sanitation during her mission to the United States. She learned about the situation in the Central Coast and visited several similarly affected communities in the Central Valley. At the end of her mission, she gave an initial report to the U.S. government at the Lantos Commission for Human Rights, and she'll be giving a complete report in September in Geneva.
Protecting drinking water from agricultural runoff is indeed a part of realizing the human right to water, and what you decide here will be felt throughout California and throughout the state, or excuse me, throughout the nation and throughout the world. Thank you for your efforts. We wish you well. Godspeed.
Thank you, Reverend, for your comments. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Eric Overeem, O-V-E-R-E-E-M. I'm a licensed pest control advisor, a certified crop advisor, and I've had the opportunity of working in the Salinas Valley for almost 30 years now. In my experience, there have been substantial changes to the overall nutrient management to grow some of the cash crops that we do. A tissue and soil test, a quick nitrous test prior to side dress, suction lysimeters to determine what's in the root zone, et cetera, et cetera. I think these have all gone a long ways to improve the nitrogen use efficiency. Also, the adoption of irrigation monitoring programs and drip irrigation have significantly improved the irrigation use efficiency in this valley. These are all practices that growers have adopted to this point, and I think the Farm Bureau Ag Alternative will continue to encourage growers to make these changes on their farms. I have many other things to say, but I wanted to bring to your attention a potential conundrum with one of the growers I work with. They are a container nursery in the Salsapuedas area of Watsonville. Their operation is entirely self-contained as far as irrigation runoff and stormwater runoff, for that matter. However, due to the quarantine imposed on them from the light brown apple moth, they are required to spray their operation with Dursban, which is a commercial formulation of chlorpyrifos. This is kind of an interesting situation where they have spent the money, made the effort to come into compliance with potential runoff issues, but yet through another regulatory agency are forced to use a somewhat undesirable pesticide in that situation. That'll wrap up my comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young, Honorable Board, staff, and fellow concerned community members. My name is Christina Chavez Wyatt. I'm past chairman of the Central Coast Young Farmers and Ranchers, and I'm here today to offer you the opinion of the San Benito County Chamber of Commerce as the organization's Government Relations Committee chairman. The San Benito County Chamber represents 450 business and community members. We feel that staff's proposal is unduly oppressive, discretionary, baseless, fiscally and practically infeasible. If implemented, it would result in the removal of hundreds of acres from production of our county alone, not to mention the increased production costs and resulting job losses and the lost ability to compete with foreign imports. We understand staff's intentions to protect water resources. However, the proposal is not based on scientific standards, contains inadequate discretion on best management practices to meet goals, is devoid of necessary metrics to analyze impacts post-implementation, and is not amenable to alteration or modification in the event of ineffectiveness. We believe that the Agricultural Coalition Alternative recognizes and satisfies the aforementioned concerns and is a far superior program for actual monitoring, testing, treating, improving regional water quality. We urge you to adopt the agricultural alternative and hope that you will consider a multitude of individuals, agencies, and businesses who feel that the alternative is a superior and an effective means of improving water quality. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
My name is Margie Kay, and I live near the Elkhorn Slough. As a volunteer who attends many meetings on water supply and water quality, I keep asking, how much will it cost to clean up and who will pay? Who will pay the public health costs? How many San Gerardos are there? I was invited a few years ago to join Salinas Valley farm workers and health care providers in a water quality seminar to learn more about it. From that, many of us made appointments to meet two county supervisors, Fernando Armenta and Simone Salinas, separately. And we also met with Assemblywoman Ana Caballero. It was obvious to that the assemblywoman and Supervisor Fernando Armenta did not understand the issues or what was needed to get the water better. Simone Salinas advised us to go to you. Here we are. I support the Monterey County Coastkeepers and Environmental Justice Coalition for Water comments. I support regulations that protect human health and the environment and that will be strong enough to restore clean water. Dipti said it. Keep your eye on the prize and what it will take us to get us there. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Good afternoon. My name is Horacio Mesquita, and I'm with the San Gerardo Cooperative. As you may know, there's 350 people there, 64 families, and a child care center. There's been pollution there since 1990. There's three wells that have been already disappeared because of high nitrates and trichloropropane. The people there were getting very, very sick, you know, skin rashes, hair falling down, red spots on their skin. And until we proved to them, you know, they almost took their clothes off and proved to the supervisors that there was a big problem there. The supervisors put in a filtration system, and as soon as they put it in, the sicknesses were gone. It cost around $1 million just for the filtration system. And then the community got a grant because of the Federal Stimulus Act of $5 million. And it cost $5 million just to get a new well 2 miles away from the community. If this next well that is right now that we're tapping in the community there gets polluted, then there's going to be more problems. I'm a farmer. I've been farming all my life. And I think that we should put water first because water is the main source of life. And we should take care of the water. I know that farming is hard and there's a lot of complexities on economics, but water is the fundamental liquid of life. So we need to take care of it. And I know you guys have a very hard decision that you guys got to make because there's two sides. And I'm in both sides. So the only thing that I wish is that you guys find a good solution for the well-being of humans and all the living organisms that need water. Thank you.
Well, we're going to try to get to that solution.
Good.
And everyone's input helps us to try to get to that solution. So thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, board members. I'm Karen Araujo, a lifelong resident of Salinas, fifth generation native of what is now Monterey County. And I, like most all folks in this room, I love this area and I care about its future. No one's paying me to be here today. I lost a day's work, less than $200, but a day's work and very important nonetheless to be here. I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to speak to you. Someone jokingly, as I interacted with someone wearing a green button here, referred to me as the enemy. I checked that joke and found that he was serious. I call no one here enemy. I believe everyone here cares deeply about the community. We just have very different strategies and fears and ways of moving forward. And we're going to do this together. And thank you for what you're doing. It's very important. I commend you on this process. I support regulations that benefit a sustainable economy and protect human health and the environment, maintaining the environment. Tourism and ag are very important to this region. A key factor to such good regulation is that they must be strong enough to restore clean water for the community use, the whole community, not just one distinct part or one industry. That's key. It's a common denominator, and I think this board, for all your great work, is moving forward, and I look forward to a very sound outcome at the end of this process. I serve on the Planning Commission for the City of Salinas, the largest municipality in this region, and I was saddened and shocked when an applicant came before us, the water company, asking for a drill permit to go down to 1,500 feet. In the presentation, it was noted that the first two higher layers were contaminated and unusable, made unusable, primarily because of nitrate contamination. Perfectly good water. We don't have any more water coming to this planet. This is it, folks. And while it is true that the damage has not occurred just by folks who are here trying to earn a living and do the right thing now, that's true. Generations of error, much of the error done in ignorance, and quite frankly, much by choice for short-term profit. Just because that was done in the past, we don't have to do it now. I'm sorry that those of us who are here now have to shoulder this heavy burden, but it's us, folks. Your job is probably a lot more cumbersome than the board that came before you, because this is a critical time. Batter up. It's you. It's us. It's this community. It's this ag community. It's these environmentalists. It's these residents. It's this community now that has to make this tough choice. I support the plan that was put forward by Mr. Shemek, the Coast Keepers, and the Environmental Justice Group. I loved what you did in February of 2010. I thought that was great. I was so excited. But I understand we're not going to get that. Okay, let's take what we've got now. I hope people will be happy with the compromises that are being made. Thank you very much for all of your hard work.
Thank you for your comments.
I want to say thank you to the board and the staff. My name is Deborah Pembroke. Okay. I'm a member of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Santa Cruz County, and I'm a resident of the Live Oak neighborhood of in Santa Cruz. There were two other members of our congregation and a Monterey congregation that had to leave, so I just wanted to share with you that they had comments they wanted to share but weren't able to stay. So members of our two congregations and a few others recently went to visit San Gerardo to learn more about nitrates and how that had affected their community. After that visit, I went to my dentist's office, and one of the women who worked as a dental assistant asked me what I'd done over the weekend. And when I told her about the visit, she shared with me that she lived in a winery in Gilroy that has well water. Her landlord had told her that the water coming out of her tap had very high levels of nitrates, and what that meant was that she shouldn't give the water to infants or small animals. She followed that direction, and because she didn't have children that were that small. But because that was the only information she had, she continued to drink the water herself and to give it to her two children. When I asked her further about this, she said that she knew that she had the option of buying bottled water, but that it was a hassle and also that it was very expensive. She said, maybe that's why I'm having all these gastric problems. I wanted to share this story with you because when we don't take steps to protect people's water, these individuals and these families often don't have the information, let alone the financial resources, to be able to protect their own safety. That's why I'm here. I'm here to, I want to say specifically, I support the proposal, the amendments that were put forward by the Coast Keepers and the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water. And I support regulation that protects humans' health, the environment, and will be strong enough to restore clean water. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Good afternoon. My name is Pallas Stanford. I'm another Unitarian Universalist. I am the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Santa Cruz County, which is over in Aptos. I personally live in Watsonville. And you've heard a lot of great testimony in just the last few minutes. I don't want to repeat it. I want to affirm it and emphasize that, and I'm coming here as a faith leader, as a religious person, but most of all, just as a human being. As Unitarian Universalists, we support the right of human beings to live on this planet and to enjoy the fruits of the planet together, and emphasize that it is our responsibility as a human community and as a human family to come together and figure out how we're going to share our resources for the benefit of all of us. As has been said, you have an incredibly difficult job in front of you. You are facing a question that is of immense complexity at a time of what is a looming crisis for us as a planet in terms of our ability to have adequate access to clean, fresh water. So I just want to say to you, please, as you are deliberating, as you are working, I know that you're committed to your task, but remember that most of the values that are being lifted up when people are talking about this issue from the perspective of agriculture are business values, values of profit, and values of that have to do with how to do business. Those are important values, but those values are ultimately trumped by the value of human life and the value of life on this planet. And we, as someone said before, water is the fundamental thing. We have to have water before we can have anything else. Only air is more important than water to our ability to sustain our life together here on the planet. So I urge you, when you're deliberating, to remember to lift up the value of human life as being the ultimate priority, and the life of our ecosystem. And also to remember, as someone has said, also the burdens of our unsustainable system fall unfairly on the shoulders of those who are not here today, those who don't have the ability to hire high-priced consultants and put together, great PowerPoint presentations for you. So remember that those are the folks that we are trying to speak for in our small way when we are here. And also I want to say to the members, to you and also to the members of the agricultural community, we love our farmers. We love agriculture. We think it's an absolutely essential industry. It's an honorable and historic lifestyle. We want to be in support and in solidarity with those folks. But we absolutely believe that the regulation of this issue cannot fall on the industry itself, just as in any other industry, like in the mortgage banking crisis or, in the oil industry. You don't leave the matter of regulation to the people who are actually, have an economic interest in it. So that's your responsibility, and I thank you for taking it on and look forward to the solutions that you come up with.
Thank you for your comments.
Chairman Young and fellow members of the board, my name is Heidi Niggemeier. I just wanted to thank you for staying late and listening to all of us. I really appreciate that because I know you all have a long drive. I'm here representing the City of Monterey and Monterey Regional Stormwater Program. This letter is from Fred Muir from the City of Monterey, and he says, "Dear Chair Young, I am writing to ask you, as you and your fellow board members consider this item during your meeting on March 14, 2011, that you also keep in mind striking a reasonable balance between what you are requiring the urban areas to do under their stormwater NPDES permits and the pollutant loads resulting from urban areas and the pollutant loads that are received from agricultural lands. Urban areas such as Monterey are being required to comply with ever-stringent requirements, including the extreme requirements of the ASBS, Special Protections, which is going to require a $1.2 million monitoring program over the next 5 years for just the peninsula cities. Yet recent research conducted by the State Water Resources Control Board and SCWRP, which is the Southern California Coastal Water Research Program, has disclosed that in most cases the ocean waters off our coast are being polluted from sources outside of our urban control. Agricultural is one of those sources. Both agricultural interests and the municipal permittees should be held to the same maximum extent practicable standard. Sincerely, Fred Muir." Some other comments that I'd like for you to consider simply is coming from the Regional Stormwater Program Manager, which I am. I just learned today about the collaborative approach that was being presented by the Grower Shipper Association and just some comments that I have on that. First of all,
How can the Grower-Shipper Association involve the public via outreach to work together to develop solutions to problem areas if the public cannot even access their data to see what the issue is or where the problem is? And if the growers have the money to fund third-party oversight, why can't they just use that money for groundwater monitoring? How can a third party be objective and enforce the process if that third party is also being paid by the growers they oversee? There are no numeric action limits or numeric goals to achieve and measure effectiveness by. Third-party-only audits once a year for implementation actions. How do they determine the BMPs they are using are effective or not, since there isn't any groundwater monitoring or any method for effectiveness assessment, as the rest of us that are regulated have to do? Reporting is done on a group basis by percentage instead of reporting who is noncompliant. So they'll tell you 10% didn't follow the rules, but you don't know who those are. Tier levels should be congruent with risk level, not size. The construction general permit uses risk levels. The construction general permit uses risk levels for construction projects, and the new Phase 2 permit may be assigning risk levels to watersheds. There should be similar risk levels for ag. Ag annual report should include effectiveness assessments. Phase 1 and 2 MS4s have this requirement. Monitoring should be equal across the board, ag, MS4s, everyone. The Regional Water Board, Region 3, has a vision for watershed health. I'm not sure if it was the 2020, but they have a vision for watershed health. And it's very difficult for those of us who are already regulated. You've got industrial, you've got commercial, you've got Phase 1 and Phase 2 MS4s. The only loophole was ag. So you're trying to have watershed health, and you get all of these great programs going throughout the watershed, and you've got these big holes, and they're called agriculture. And I think it's just about time that we leveled out the playing field and everybody had the same requirements. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you for being here.
Good evening, afternoon, chair, members of the board. I am Ann Myhre, M-Y-H-R-E, from San Ardo. Running late. I'm facilitating a meeting at 7 o'clock, so I'm not too happy to be so late. I have prepared some written statements for you, but I want to deviate from that for a moment. First, I would say that I will participate in some sort of monitoring program that is cooperative, if that is available. I'm a very small grower. I consider myself a small operator with trees on drip. I don't think there's anything I can do to improve my operation, but I would appreciate an independent audit. And so far, I don't think that's going to happen from the Regional Water Quality Control Board if they think I'm in compliance. So I would appreciate someone coming and talking to me on my farm to tell me what I could do better. The second thing I would say is I have become alarmed by what the strawberry people said today, because I think I am now tier 3, and I have gone along thinking that if I have 40 acres of walnuts on drip irrigation, I am tier 1. But I happen to own some other property with my husband that is leased by another operator, small property. 55 miles from my home, my sister and I own a very, very small property with 4 very small operators. We do a kind of a rotation, a dry land irrigated, and for one of those irrigators, I write the farm plan. Okay, I'm still tier 1. It just occurred to me that 160 miles from my home, but still in this region, and I hate to divulge this stuff in public, because I don't think it's any of your business, but I own over 1,000 acres of irrigated property, a minority interest with my cousin and other family members. But that probably puts my 45 acres of walnuts into tier 3. That's not fair. That is not fair. And it's something you haven't been thinking about. And I don't want to be burdened with it, so I don't know how that happens. But I will read my prepared remarks to the extent that my minutes remain. For many of us who appear before you today, we are representing ourselves, paying our own way, giving our own time to help this board and staff understand the impact of your actions. We typically operate small acreages, and we earn very limited income. And we are going to be required to absorb additional expenses and then take on additional duties without compensation dependent upon your actions.
As such a person, I am responsible for farm plans required by the current ag waiver program. I can honestly say that I resent the time I spend formalizing these plans because, to my way of thinking, they serve absolutely no purpose. That is not to say that I am not mindful of the unique characteristics of my property, that I have been continuously developing and revising informal management plans in my mind since I attended my first conservation meeting in 1955. Certainly, water quality is among the things I consider. However, I oppose staff recommendations to change the current plans and process, and it would be helpful if this board would exercise restraint when considering modifications to that expiring plan. The properties I represent are not going to be better managed because of these new demands. Furthermore, I cannot justify additional management expense, and still under this order, it seems designed to impact my operation in just that way, requiring more time, more money, and the intent ultimately being that it take away my historic use of this property, some of which has been irrigated since 1900. Would somebody like my written comments?
Okay, sure. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you. My name is Jennifer Clary. I'm with Clean Water Action and Clean Water Fund, and I hope to stun you with my brevity. I want to speak in support of the Monterey Bay Keeper and Environmental Justice Coalition for Water proposal, and I also had a chance to listen to the Farm Bureau's new proposal. Unfortunately, it sounded a lot like the one that they presented in November, and I think my biggest concern is groundwater. I should tell you that I come from a drinking water perspective. I serve on several stakeholder groups representing drinking water interests, and one of the stakeholder groups I've served on for years is the Gamma Public Advisory Committee. So I just wanted to clarify a few misconceptions about the Gamma database. Gamma database is a collection of the data that several public agencies gather. It has data from drinking water supply wells, DPR data, state water board monitoring wells. And it does have some data about from USGS. USGS has been doing monitoring for the Gamma program for several years. And one problem with that monitoring program, it's a great program, we've got lots of information, but it is voluntary. The participants elect to do it. So there's always been a concern that the data is going to be skewed by the fact that it's sort of a self-selected group. The other difficulty is one of the purposes of the Gamma program was to develop a trend analysis, like which way is water quality going and what do we have to worry about. But, you know, between all the funding problems, we've never got to the trend piece of it. We're just barely getting through the first set of data. So I should say that I've been active in the Central Valley ag waiver process. And one thing that I worked with Pacific Institute on for that process was to do a regression analysis. So what we took from the Gamma data is we took wells for which we had a significant amount of data over 10 to 20 years. And we took a look at what the nitrate concentrations were and how they sort of penciled out if you kept drawing the line. And I have no idea. I'm sure it's not scientifically accurate, but it's the best we could do in form of trend analysis. And under that analysis, it looked like we just did Kern County because it had the biggest nitrate problem, and it showed that the number of wells exceeding the drinking water standard would double in the next 10 years. And I think that's something that we have to understand as part of putting this program in, is we don't just want to solve the problems we have. We want to prevent the problems that are coming up. And so one way we have to do that is we have to have a strong monitoring program. And the biggest shortcoming of the Farm Bureau proposal is that it doesn't have that information. And voluntary groundwater monitoring doesn't work because it isn't going to go into the Gamma database. You're not going to be able to do trend analysis. And if they're concerned about information getting out that shouldn't get out, I should tell you that the Gamma program doesn't reveal well location, and it wouldn't reveal well location for any of the monitoring done here as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments.
Good evening. My name is Sarah Dameron, and I'm speaking on behalf of the five Surfrider Foundation chapters here in the Region 3.
Could you repeat your name again?
Sorry, Sarah Dameron.
Sarah.
Thanks. Okay. And I kind of foresaw this moment coming, so I actually have type statements, but I will paraphrase. So obviously our members care about the protection of coastal ocean ecosystems, which are impacted by aquatic conditions, and the ability of people to use and enjoy coastal waters beneficially. So that's the context in which I'm making comments today. We really care about what's in front of us, which is the continued impairment of our coastal water bodies and groundwater that's occurring by irrigated agriculture as a class. We realize it's, you know, some folks are doing really well and some folks maybe aren't. We do appreciate the fact that a number of folks really have taken it upon themselves to make improvements, but that's not why we're here today. We're here because there is continued impairment of our water bodies. And specifically, water bodies that are identified as supporting other beneficial uses, such as contact recreation, fishing, drinking water, these types of things, need to be protected and cleaned up to support those uses. So we believe those efforts need to prevent and remediate pollution should be implemented in as timely a manner as possible to support those other beneficial uses. We do support the change from the existing waiver to the proposed waiver that does require individual discharge monitoring, because we do agree that it will facilitate a measure of changes, both, you know, where are the problems exactly and how are we doing better, and let us know that, you know, these management practices that we're putting into place actually are succeeding or maybe they're failing. And we appreciate that that's included for Tier 3 dischargers, but we feel that this really is the kind of a bottom rung. This is the very least amount of individual discharge monitoring that should occur if we're really looking to solve the problem. We're generally concerned that the tiering criteria might be too narrow. Tier 3 is not necessarily inclusive of all operations that could be significant contributors of pollutants to 303D listed water bodies. For example, Tier 3 errs in focusing on two specific pesticides as opposed to considering a range of substances that cause toxicity, when toxicity is really what we're seeking to eliminate here. And in doing so, we feel like, as a number of speakers on all sides have pointed out, that people are just going to switch to other pesticides, and that's not what any of us, I don't think, want to do. So there are a couple options. You could expand Tier 3 to be more inclusive of operations that discharge into 303D listed water bodies that also include the broader list of pesticides that have been identified as harmful or that are causing toxicity in these water bodies. Or you could extend individual discharge monitoring requirement to Tier 2, or we could go back to the February 2010 option. Just putting some things out there for you. But basically, we support what we're trying, I think what we're all trying to do here, which is eliminate toxicity, reduce pollution. So thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you for your comments.
Roy Lump, I live in Hollister Farm in Fresno, Merced in San Benito County.
And that was Roy in the last name?
Yeah.
Your last name, sir?
OMPA. I would like to make a couple of proposals. Number one, if all these people that have been here speaking today that eat the chow that we produce think that we're doing such a bad job keeping them fed, I suggest that they all be, they're not calling this a tax, they're calling it a fee. So I think they all should pay a fee to be sure that we can afford to keep the water the way they think it should be. I'd like to remind them also that a lot of our nitrogen comes from thunder showers from God's domain that nobody's talked about. Also, this watershed starts in San Benito County in the San Benito River, Pajaro, about 28 miles west of Colingo. And between here and Colingo, and I'll be nice, I'll say feces from the cattle and the horses, the deer and the pigs create a hell of a lot of nitrogen, and water runs downhill and we're on the bottom. And nobody's addressed that. And that water basically on light years, what little, when the river does run, percolates down into the aquifers, which are fed from Trespinas west. There don't get much percolation above that. And that would be my recommendation, that all these people have got all these good ideas in town, contribute to see that we have this done. The other thing is, there's two other possible solutions. In Fresno County, where I farm, these part of these same people, the environmentalists and the fish and game, are proposing within the next 12 years to take out 1.5 million acres out of production and put it back in habitat. So if we took 1.5 million acres out of production here in Salinas, put it back to habitat, their water would be beautiful. That would be one proposal I'd make. And the other one is that nobody's mentioned, only that some sea otter ate some moss out there and died. That's because a sea otter have ate all the clams and abalone there is for 50 miles up and down the coast. Because I'm 84 years old, and I used to come over here clamming all the time and catch some beautiful 6 and 8 inch clams, abalone. There's none around. The sea otters ate them all. So I think that somebody on that committee should check in to see how much influence Monterey Bay Aquarium and that lab, whatever they call it, at Moss Landing, is input that's having in putting it in to blame the farmers for putting all this nitrogen in the water. They don't want it in there, and they're passing it off as screwing up your drinking water. If the truth was really found out, you'd find out that they have a big input in what's going on here today. Thank you very much. And
sir, I didn't, sir, I didn't catch you over here.
Well, it don't make any difference. I'm alive and well. Thank you.
No, wait a minute.
Okay. I think we got close enough.
Okay.
And we'll remember him.
I just wanted his last name, that's all.
I heard OMPA.
Okay. Okay. Last speaker, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan Alley, just like the bowling alley. Excuse me, I'm a little congested. I'm with the Environmental Defense Center, and I'm basically exactly who we all want to see at 6 o'clock at night. I'm an attorney about to talk about process. And I can guarantee that no one else has brought up these points today, so at least it's a little refreshing. The current order, the current existing agriculture waiver, R3-2010-0040, expires on March 31st. The section of the Water Code 13269, subsection F, that refers to renewal of conditional waivers, says that those decisions must be made at a hearing, which means that if you continue today's hearing, you cannot make that decision probably prior to March 31st, which means that de facto, this order is going to expire. Now, I've also heard a consideration of a quote-unquote administrative renewal of this process, and I refer back to the Water Code, Section 13223, authorizes your board to delegate some authority to the executive officer. However, it contains several enumerated exceptions. One is that the executive officer may not promulgate any regulation, and I think a lot of these folks would be surprised to hear someone say that the ag waiver is not a regulation. In fact, the government code, which defines such thing, says that a regulation is essentially any order that comes from an agency which implements the laws that that agency is tasked to enforce. So by that plain definition, the waiver is, in fact, a regulation. Even if you were to operate under the fiction that it's not, the second enumerated exception says that the executive officer may not issue, modify, or revoke any waste discharge requirement. Now, it's nonsensical to me that the executive officer is prohibited from doing those things and yet has some authority to waive a waste discharge requirement. And that's exactly what a conditional waiver is. It's a waiver of waste discharge requirements. I've seen these green buttons that says, don't waive agriculture. If you take that literally, that means everyone has to get a WDR. So That doesn't really make sense to me. Anyway, bottom line is the only way for you to renew this waiver is for your board to constitute a full quorum and make a decision at a hearing after notice. Now, what's the import of this? Well, after March 31st, there's no more waiver. There's no more waiver of waste discharge requirements. That means that everybody who's discharging or threatening discharge has to file under 13260 a report of waste discharge requirements. And then your board has to, under 13263, prescribe waste discharge requirements. Now, none of us really wanted to get to this point where every single individual discharger enrolled under the waiver has to file for a WDR. Unfortunately, it's been 2 years or more since we've been in this process. And things have been renewed and renewed and renewed inappropriately, I might add. And unfortunately, for everybody involved, we've kind of backed ourselves into a corner. And so I am looking forward to this requirement being implemented on April 1st. Funny day for it. But until you can renew the waiver, i.e. until your board constitutes a quorum, I'm looking forward to all these reports of waste discharge, and I'm looking forward to you guys issuing waste discharge requirements. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments.
Buffy.
Okay, that concludes our public comment session for today. We will give notice as soon as possible as to when we're going to continue this meeting. Speak up louder. Okay. We're going to give notice as soon as we can as to when this meeting is going to be continued. And we have some idea, Mr. Briggs, as to when we can do that, at least when we can make the decision.
Well, do that as soon as possible. I don't know if I'll be able to check everybody's schedules tomorrow, but possibly Monday.
Okay. All right. And I just want to thank everybody who spoke today, even those that have left that can't hear my comments. But we've been through a couple of years of this already, and I appreciate everyone's input into this. We do have some divergent perspectives on how to deal with what the issues are, and I'm grateful for being involved in the process at this point in time. I look to being I'm grateful for being involved in the solution to this, and the board is going to ferret out everything and deliberate and come up with recommendations for staff to consider. And I anticipate maybe in the summer we'll be ready to really have a vote on something that has been through a lengthy review.
Once we do have a date, we'll post that on our website. And a lot of you are familiar with the ag page that we have on our website, so we'll post it there.
Okay, we're done for today. Thank you very much.
A reminder for you. Let me know. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, we need to collect those. Thank you. Sure.